usual for a patient.
All right. Today is a kind of special lecture because we're going to basically discuss. We're not going to do chapter 28. Okay, that's on alternating current, and we could spend the rest of the semester talking about how current increases and decreases. If you need to study for that for your MCATs, let me know. Okay. We're not going to do chapter 29, which is Maxwell's equations, but the lecture I'm going to give today will summarize the key points about chapter 29, and I will expect you to know the things I talk about today, or at least remember them, okay? So you should take some notes, but this is meant to also be kind of a fun lecture, because the point of what you've been doing since September is about to become revealed to you, all right? Much as it became revealed to scientists in the 1800s who were laboring to understand electricity and magnetism, summarizing their discoveries in mathematical equations, and then finding out that those equations seem to have a lot to do with one another. And all of this culminated in the late 1800s. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. Okay? So, what is light? Let's start with that question. This is a question that had bothered people for a very long time up through the 1800s. It delights our senses. Our eyes are exactly tuned to observe the world around us in what we now refer to simply as visible light. We see many colors, okay? We give them names, we interpret what we see, we build art off of what we see. But what is light? Is it just something? I mean, if it's something, if it's not nothing, then you should be able to understand its nature if it's part of the natural world. And this question had bothered a lot of people up through the late 1800s. Now, as we'll see today, that question has a long history within the history of science itself. And it really begins its first scientific inquiry with Galileo Galilei, who lived from 1564 to 1642. He is considered the first modern scientist. He was born in Italy, he died in Italy. And he was an experimental genius. He loved to play with the tools of the trade. He loved to invent new things. He invented a series of water-based clocks that he could use to make very accurate time measurements for his experiments. He combined mathematics with his observations. He was very good at mathematics, geometry, and algebra, which were the high point of mathematics in the day. And he combined that understanding of mathematics as a language with his observations of the natural world. And he argued very passionately, and much to the offense of many people in religious establishment in Italy, that this was the way to understand the natural world, and not other means, certainly not philosophy. He believed that philosophy was a pile of crap, okay? Because it often led to logical statements that simply led to conclusions about the natural world that were demonstrably false. And he would get into long, drunken arguments with people, long arguments and letters with people about this stuff, and he offended a lot of people, okay? One of his key things that he did during his life is that he perfected the telescope very early on, when he was a very young professor. And the telescope had already been invented, but he perfected it as a means to spot warships very far off the coast of Italy. And he sold his invention to the government of Italy, made a ton of cash, and basically secured a position for himself in the court of a wealthy noble for the rest of his life. And he used that then to do whatever he wanted. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to turn the telescope to other purposes, and he turned it to the heavens. Now, looking at the heavens was considered something that was essentially studying God, because the Bible seemed to have a lot to say about the heavens and their infallibility and their perfection. And so he thought that he would look a little closer at it and confirm all of that. But what he observed were things that not only set Italian society on its head, but led to his being convicted by the Inquisition for heresy. The first thing that he observed was Jupiter. He turned his telescope on Jupiter, and he noticed that it seemed to have tiny little stars that moved around it, and not anything else, certainly not the Earth. And so he called these he named the stars in honor of his rich benefactor, and published a long treatise on his observations with hand drawings of all his observations. And it was this that set him off on the path to believing that the Earth was not, in fact, the center of the universe, as had been taught for a very long time. That there are bodies in the heavens that orbit other things, like the moons of Jupiter orbiting Jupiter, and that, therefore, the universe couldn't possibly be centered only on the Earth. He then turned his telescope on the stars and observed the imperfection of the sun by observing sunspots. This also got him in a lot of trouble. There was a lot of debate in the scientific community about what he was actually seeing. But eventually his mouth got him in trouble, and he was tried and convicted by the Inquisition in Italy, and he was put under house arrest for the remainder of his life. Being put under house arrest only redoubled his efforts, and he actually started conducting experiments on what we now call Newton's laws in mechanics. Interestingly, Isaac Newton was born just a year after Galileo Galilei died. And it was Isaac Newton that invented the calculus and really started to quantify the laws of nature and eventually came up with what we now think is the famous force equals mass times acceleration observation. The first real law of nature written in mathematics. Galileo was fascinated with light. One of the big questions at the time was whether or not light traveled instantaneously from one point to another, or rather that it traveled simply at a very great speed. It was at the time clear that sound took time to travel. I mean, you could easily go a few hundred meters away, clap your hands, and it would take a moment for the sound to arrive. The light would get to your eyes first, you could see the person clapping, but the sound would arrive later. So go to a Mustangs football game. Watch the band on the other side of the stadium. Watch the drummers. You'll see that they hit about 2 to 4 tenths of a second before the sound actually arrives at your ears. Okay? And now if you were really careful and had a stopwatch, you could actually measure the speed of sound by doing that. Okay? Well, Galileo was interested in studying the speed of light. And he devised an experiment to do that, which you can actually easily do with sound instead. Okay? So you and a couple of friends get some air horns. One of the persons with an air horn stand on the steps of Dallas Hall. Take the other person with the other air horn and put them about 100 meters away. So somewhere down here. Okay, at the south end of this quad, at the north end of the boulevard. And all you have to do is stand by your friend on Dallas Hall steps, okay, signal to them that they should hit their horn, they'll fire it, and then when the other person 100 meters away hears that sound, they're supposed to fire back. And so you get sound to make a round trip of about 200 meters, and you can time that. Okay, and that takes a few tenths of a second. Then you take that other person and move them 200 meters away and repeat the experiment. Now sound has to make a 400 meter round trip. By making a few measurements, you take out human reaction time, which is about 2 tenths of a second. So Professor Olmos and Tunk do this experiment with the students in the Physics of Musical Instruments class to show them the limitations of the speed of sound and its finite speed. And you can make a measurement of the speed of sound that's going to be about 5%, which is pretty good for just standing around on a college campus blowing some air horns. Try to get permit to do this before you make noise. Apparently noise on a college campus is a crime after September 11th. So you'll get shut down by the cops if you don't have like 22 signatures on a form to do this. Okay, just a word of warning from having seen this happen this year. Now Galileo proposed this experiment, but he didn't propose it for sound. He proposed it for light. So what he proposed was that he and an assistant, probably the equivalent of a graduate student today, would each take lamps. And Galileo took one of what is probably one of his very accurate water clocks, and he went up on the top of a hill. And he had his assistant go miles away to another hill. And they stood there with their lamps, and Galileo would open his lamp, and then the assistant would, when he saw the light, open his lamp in response, and Galileo would use his clock to try to measure the time difference. The problem is Galileo failed to appreciate just how fast light moves. I mean, the furthest you could get away and still see somebody on the Earth's surface is about 50 or 60 miles, depending on the terrain. And so in that distance, it takes a millionth of a second for light to make the trip. There's no clock made of water that Galileo could have built to measure that kind of time difference. Okay, so Galileo didn't succeed in measuring the speed of light. He wasn't even sure if it was finite or infinite, but he was able to say that it's at least this fast. And that was all he could say. And that was, you know, that was in the 1600s. Not maybe 20 years after Galileo does his experiment on light, an astronomer named Ole Rømer turns the telescope on the heavens, again looking at Jupiter. Jupiter is a very popular thing to look at back then, because even with weak telescopes, you could reveal a lot of detail about it, as it's so big. Rømer realized that if light traveled at a finite speed, that depending on the time of year that you observe Io, one of the biggest moons of Jupiter, going around Jupiter, that if light takes longer to reach you in some seasons than in others, as the Earth goes around the Sun, that might make an apparent shift in the orbital period of Io. And so he observed. He observed over the course of a year. He took a lot of measurements. And using this, and using a modern interpretation of his units, because he had funny units back then, the meter hadn't been invented yet. Okay, so that just gives you a sense of where we are in the history of science. Nowadays, using his units, we would say that he measured the speed of light using this observation to be about 220,000 kilometers a second, or 2.2 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. That's within about 30% of the correct value. That's a pretty good measurement for somebody who was doing, you know, this kind of thing just decades after the telescope had really been turned on the heavens in the first place. So Ole Rømer is largely credited with being the first person to make a kind of measurement of the finite speed of light. He at least was able to say, yes, light travels at a finite speed. It doesn't travel instantaneously across the universe. And he did this in about 1676. Okay? Let's take a little diversion for a second and talk about sound again. Because sound is a phenomenon that is fundamentally a wave in nature. Okay? Its fundamental substance is to be a wave. So a wave, in its simplest form, can be described simply as a regular oscillation in something, like the amplitude of this line. Okay? So over some period of time, this ball here, attached to this wiggling string, makes one up-down motion. Okay? And the time it takes for that point to go up and then down and back to where it started is what's known as one period of the wave. Okay? So waves are just regular oscillations. And they have, denoted with the letter T, a period of oscillation. That is the time it takes for the wave to complete one cycle of its motion. Now you're back to where you started, and then the wave repeats again. Okay. In addition, if you think of the wave as a spatial distribution of this kind of vibration, the distance from one point on the wave to another similar point. Okay. So imagine we have a wave like this. The distance from one point to another similar point, say this crest here and this crest here, is denoted by lambda, the wavelength. Okay, and this is in meters. Okay, so this is the distance, say, between one peak and another peak in the wave, or one trough, the bottom of the oscillation, and another trough. The time it takes for one wavelength to pass by a point is the period. And so you can get the speed of the wave quite simply from this picture here. If it takes one period of the wave to go one wavelength, then the speed v will be lambda over t. One wavelength distance over the amount of time it takes for it to travel one wavelength, which is capital T, the period of the wave. We have a special symbol for 1 over t. We call it f, the frequency. And then again here we have the wavelength. Okay, the frequency is the rate at which, say, peaks of the wave pass you, 1 per second, 2 per second, 3 per second. Those units of per second have the name hertz, and they're named after somebody I'll talk about in a little bit. Okay? Waves are everywhere. They're in the water. They're in the air. Again, sound is a wave. My vocal cords put pressure on the air. Those pressure waves have variable intensity, and they travel from my mouth, relatively loudly, I'm told, into your ears. You have little bones in your ears that will vibrate in response to changes in air pressure. Okay? That's why it hurts to go up in a plane when the pressure changes. It's a closed air system. It hurts when the pressure changes, and that's a bad change. But for sound waves, it's not so bad unless you go to a concert and it's very loud. All right, so those little bones vibrate, and your brain then, your ear converts those vibrations into electrical signals, and then your brain converts those electrical signals into something you can interpret, language, sound, music, whatever it is. Okay, but fundamentally, the way that we communicate vocally is by waves. And the language of waves was established in the 1800s, that they are regular variations with a wavelength and a frequency. Okay, anything that's a wave travels in a medium. Sound travels in air. Water waves travel in water. Okay, there has to be some kind of thing, some kind of medium that can be compressed and then relaxed in order to generate the wave. Without a medium, you shouldn't have a wave. Okay, that was the established understanding of waves. So you need a medium. That is something the wave travels in. And that medium's properties help to determine the speed of the wave. So the speed of sound is fixed by the properties of air, its ability to compress at a certain temperature. Speed of sound changes with temperature. Speed of sound changes with medium. If you yell underwater, the speed of sound is different underwater. So you'll hear things, but they'll sound different to you. Okay? That was the established understanding of waves, both mathematically and experimentally. Okay, so with that little diversion, whose importance will be revealed shortly, let's get back to our friend, the laws of electromagnetism. Okay? And let's go back and do a kind of retrospective on what we've studied this semester. The first fundamental law of electricity and magnetism that we studied was Gauss's law for electric fields. Gauss's law, in short, says that electric charge is the source of electric field. Okay? It also tells you that field lines emanate from positive charges, and you can play around with that equation and see that when you have a positive charge, the field lines have to point parallel to the normal pointing outward from your Gaussian surface. That's out from the charge. When it's negative, they have to point in. So this law also tells us the direction that electric field lines point. In addition, it's outside the scope of this course. I think we make the majors do this at some point, but you can actually derive Coulomb's law from this equation. Coulomb's law, the force between two charges due to their electric fields, is a consequence of Gauss's law. Gauss's law is more fundamental than Coulomb's law because it can be used to derive it. Okay? And this is just a statement of geometry, field, and charge. It's very powerful. Okay, so while proof of this is outside the scope of this course, it's enough to know that this statement is true, that it's possible to derive Coulomb's law from this. And this means that Gauss's law also tells us how charges respond to one another by interacting through electric fields. So it contains force as well as simply field. And finally, you know, all the business we went through about electric potential and potential differences and this being, you know, you can combine this with conservation of energy to then talk about how energy changes from one point in an electric field to another. You can use this to get back to Ohm's law, Kirchhoff's law, by combining it with conservation of energy. This is a truly fundamental statement about electricity. A truly fundamental statement, and is, to this day, still one of the fundamental laws of electricity. But that's what it tells us. That's what the math says. Charge is the source. There are forces between charges through electric field. And combined with conservation of energy, you can make grand statements about electric circuits, lightning, anything involving electric fields. Later on, we encounter Gauss's law for magnetic fields. And there, we sort of had a much simpler version. Okay? Because the fundamental source of magnetic field in nature are little loops of current, atoms, electrons going around nuclei, there are no magnetic charges that have ever been observed. There is no point charge, no north charge, and no south charge that has ever been isolated in nature. And therefore, Gauss's law for magnetic fields says that this integral is always zero. And basically what it tells us is there are no magnetic charges, at least none that have been discovered yet. Okay? There are actually people in the SMU physics department looking for these at the Large Hadron Collider. Magnetic fields will equally enter and leave any closed volume by going through the penetrating through the surface of that volume. That's what Gauss's law says. That's the integral on the left. Magnetic field times little pieces of the area of a volume equals zero. Okay? So this is a simpler statement, but it has a powerful implication, which is that if it's always true, there are no magnetic charges in nature. We then encountered Ampere's law. Ampere's law lets us do some calculations, finally, because we do know that magnetic fields derive from moving charge. And so we needed a law that expressed that. And through much experimentation in the 1800s, you know, this law was arrived at by Ampere, that the magnetic field is related to the current enclosed in a mathematical loop that you draw around the source of current. So moving charge is the source of magnetic field. That's one thing that equation says. And then again, it's outside the scope of this course, but the Biot-Savart law is a consequence of Ampere's law. Biot-Savart law is not fundamental. This is. And Biot-Savart can be derived from this. Okay? So that means that Ampere's law also encapsulates how electric charges respond to magnetic fields, because that's the substance of the Biot-Savart law, the force between currents. And then finally, we encountered Faraday's law, which says that a changing magnetic flux induces an electromotive force, an electric potential difference, and that that electric potential difference will do work, it will drive current, and that current will resist the change in flux. That's the minus sign in this thing. Okay? So these laws, these four equations, which are derived from careful experimentation over about a century, are to this day, we believe, a complete summary of electricity and magnetism. And everything that you can do with electricity and magnetism can be derived from these laws. Let's revisit Faraday's law. Let's dress it in a new way. Okay? Because we have this thing on the left, electric potential difference, E. Okay? An electric potential difference, if you recall, originally we noted this as the potential, the difference in electric potential between two points A and B. Okay? And we wrote that as the integral of E dot dr, where dr is the path that you follow through the potential from point A to point B. Well, okay, that E there is just delta VAB, so you can just stick that in there. And when you do that, you see what Faraday's law really says. Faraday's law really says that a changing magnetic flux induces an electric field. Okay? Digest that for a second. Changing magnetic field, or flux, will induce an electric field in response to it. It says deeply, somehow, that electricity, electric field, and magnetism are really fundamentally connected to each other through their fields. So let's take a look at these. These are the equations that we have so far. Okay, we have Gauss's law for electric fields and magnetic fields. And they're very close, but they're not exactly in the same form. One of them has charge, the other one doesn't. And then we have Ampere's law, okay, which involves B dot dr, some path in a magnetic field. And then we have Faraday's law, which involves E dot dr, some path in an electric field. But on the right-hand side, things look very different. They're so close, okay? So what we're going to do now is something that a brilliant scientist named James Clerk Maxwell did. He had collected these laws together in one place and started thinking a great deal about what they mean in relation to one another and whether they have a connection to one another. Again, it was very, you know, we've observed some of this, right? That somehow a changing magnetic flux induces a current. This is a very strange thing. It suggests that they have something to do with one another. And so what Maxwell considered was, what do these laws look like in a region of free space? That is, a region of space devoid of charges. So, you know, go out into space. There's like one hydrogen atom per cubic meter. Okay, make a box. You're likely not to enclose any atoms. And then think about what if there were electric and magnetic fields penetrating the box and going through that region. These would be the equations that would describe them. Okay, so now Gauss's law for electric fields looks just like Gauss's law for magnetic fields, because we're in a region where there are no charges to enclose, and the right-hand sides are just zero. Okay, so there's a beautiful symmetry now between these two equations. Ampere's law, there are no currents because we're not enclosing any charge, so I is zero. Okay, so now we have B dot dr equals zero, but we still have Faraday's law. Faraday's law doesn't change. There could still be a changing magnetic field through the region, even though there are no charges. The source could be from some other place. And that could give rise to an electric field. And it was Maxwell, this young man named James Clerk Maxwell, who lived from 1831 to 1879, who really put this all together. He took a leap, a bold leap. He was a brilliant scientist working in Britain at the time, and his legacy really is to have united electricity and magnetism into a single force. one which we recognize today as one of only four forces operating in the universe. He developed, in addition to this piece of work, he developed a theory of large numbers of particles. Dennis probably has heard of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. This is the Maxwell in there. And he made the first true color photograph, which is an interesting side note of him. This is him holding his color wheel. He was sort of obsessed with light and color and really, you know, dug deep to understand it. Interestingly, he published his theory of the electromagnetic field, this unified electric and magnetic phenomenon, in 1864. This was just a few years before Michael Faraday died. He was very old at the time. But he did read this manuscript before he died, and it was Faraday who really initiated the revolution in understanding electricity and magnetism by introducing the concept of the field in the first place, this idea that charges can reach out through a field and communicate with other charges. And it was Maxwell that really brought this idea to its final conclusion. And it's very rare in science that you initiate a revolution and then get to see where it leads, okay? And at least Faraday got to see where this conclusion came to before the next revolution started. Here's what Maxwell's great leap was. Okay, fine. These equations, Gauss's laws, they look fine. They're nice and symmetric. E dot dA, B dot dA, zeros on the right-hand side. Faraday's law, well, you can't do much with that because experiment had confirmed that that really was the relationship between electric field and changing magnetic flux. This was Maxwell's great idea. What if we're missing a piece of Ampere's law? What if there's a piece of Ampere's law we simply haven't observed yet? That in free space, where there are no currents enclosed, you could still have a changing electric flux, an electric field passing through this region of free space that changes over time. What if that could induce a magnetic field in the same way that a changing magnetic flux can induce an electric field? Nobody at this time had any evidence that this was the case. I mean, this truly is a leap. This truly is the fundamental essence of the scientific method. He took previous experimental information that had been synthesized into a hypothesis, a mathematical framework, these equations. And then he said, wait a second, if Faraday's law is right, maybe Ampere's law should say this. He made a hypothesis. And that hypothesis could be tested, for instance, by measuring magnetic fields inside charging capacitors. And it was verified. A charging capacitor contains a changing electric field, and magnetic fields are set up in response to that change. This was a bold move. And, you know, you only hear about the people that succeed, so you're hearing about Maxwell, and who knows what other people tried before Maxwell came along. But he was right. He was lucky in the sense that he was right. Okay? Here's the catch. Maxwell then asked, okay, great, so if this is true, we have this beautiful symmetry now between changing magnetic fields give rise to an electric field, and a changing electric field gives rise to a magnetic field. What do these equations describe? What is all of this stuff that's in here? And at the time, it was known that you could actually express the fields in terms of things that were actually connected directly to the potentials. So he played with the mathematics a little bit, and he found that fundamentally, what these four equations describe in free space, a region absent of any charges, is an electromagnetic wave propagating through space. A wave of increasing electric field, shown in red, that gives rise to an increasing magnetic field in response, shown in blue. They rise to a maximum, and then one begins to decrease, pulling the other one down with it, simultaneously. In free space, you have a wave of electric fields and magnetic fields flowing through space, and the velocity is perpendicular to both of these fields. Okay, and that's what's illustrated here. You have electric field on sort of on the y-axis, magnetic field on the x-axis, and then along z you have the propagation of this electromagnetic phenomenon, this electromagnetic wave. Okay? Here's the real kicker. If this is true, then you should be able to calculate the speed of the wave. Okay? You can write down the solutions to Maxwell's equations, their sine waves, and you can then take derivatives and calculate the speed of the wave. And what they found was that the speed of the wave was exactly equal to that thing that I wrote down last time, 1 over the square root of epsilon naught mu naught, which is equal to 3.00 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. Now, at this point in the late 1800s, the speed of light had been measured to much better than old Romer had done it. He did it to about 30%. By the time Maxwell was doing his work, it was known to a few percent. And it was very obvious when you calculated this number that this was exactly equal to the measured value of the speed of light. And so it was from this synthesis that Maxwell did, combining four equations that describe these seemingly originally disparate phenomena, recognizing that they had a beautiful symmetry between them, extending that symmetry, making a new prediction, the consequence of that prediction being that waves of electricity and magnetism can propagate through free space, and they do so at the speed of light. Light, therefore, must be an electromagnetic wave. This was another hypothesis. If this is true, then you should be able to vibrate electric charge and make a changing electric field that sets up a changing magnetic field, and that will propagate through space at the speed of light. Okay? And so the race was on to find if you could do this, if you could control the production of light. Now, for the technology that they had at the time, the easiest thing to do was to make electromagnetic waves that now are what we refer to as radio waves. They have long wavelengths. We can't see them, but they can penetrate buildings, they can go to receivers and then be picked up. There was a man named Heinrich Hertz, a German physicist who was really the first after Maxwell did his work to satisfactorily demonstrate the existence of electromagnetic waves. And he did so by transmitting from one part of his laboratory to another information through these waves using only the vibration of electric charge on one side and then having a receiver on the other, just an antenna that then detects the electromagnetic waves by itself responding with vibrating electric charge to the wave, and then that vibration is transmitted into something you can hear, sound, light, something like that. Okay? So it was a low-key experiment, but it was the first to really satisfactorily demonstrate that the implication of Maxwell's equations, that is, that you can vibrate electric charge and make electromagnetic waves that travel at the speed of light. Heinrich Hertz was the first to really do this. Not long after, actually, the year that Hertz died, his work became very public. And based on his work, two individuals, Guillermo Marconi, who lived from 1874 to 1937, and Robert Heyer. Does anybody, before reading that, know that name? Heyer Hall, yeah? First president of SMU, okay? They both simultaneously did experiments that led to, that demonstrated that you could communicate over long distances using electromagnetic waves. It was Marconi who really invented, I mean, really, he was an inventor. He knew how to drive a business from start to finish. He was very bright. He developed the very first radio telegraph system, the wireless telegraph system. Telegraph had been around for decades at that point, but he showed how you could make it wireless using the transmission of electromagnetic waves from one place to another over vast distances, no more having to lay cable everywhere to run communication across the United States, for instance. He demonstrated this shortly after the death of Hertz. I mean, he really jumped on this work and turned it into something real and demonstrated the first prototype radio telegraph system in the same year that Hertz died. And it's astounding how aggressive he must have been, right? Heyer, in the exact same year, because he saw a lecture on electromagnetic waves in 1891, but then when this work really became public, it likely accelerated his own work. He was able to do a communication from his laboratory to a jail downtown. And at the time, he was living in Georgia. This is before SMU was founded. Okay, so SMU wasn't in Dallas at the time. He was at the time at Southwestern University, which became SMU. And he communicated from his lab to the jail downtown using electromagnetic waves. So he also had a prototype radio telegraph system, but it was Marconi who really won the race. I mean, Marconi really pushed this thing. He was really good. Okay. Incidentally, the American Physical Society has an award for students named in honor of Robert Heyer, and the department offers one to undergraduates as well. Okay? Electromagnetic waves. The coda to the story of Maxwell's equations giving rise to the idea that light is an electromagnetic wave is that at the time, physicists got hubris. Well, physicists always have hubris. and bold statements were made. There were parallel developments in the theory of large numbers of particles, statistical mechanics, or thermodynamics, as it's called when you're talking about temperature and pressure. Lots of understanding about nature had come to fruition at the end of the 1800s, that light was an electromagnetic wave, that there were very likely things called atoms that make up all of the matter that we see, and that could be understood simply from their statistical properties. Okay? With these ideas in hand, and with Newton's mechanics allowing us to calculate the motion of the heavens, the falling of apples on Earth, the building of bridges, there was a lot of hubris in the physics community that we were probably a decade away from understanding everything about the universe. Okay? Yeah, on our tiny little planet in this unfashionable western spiral arm of this galaxy, every, 100 years or so, somebody gets up and says, we've done it, we've understood everything. There are just a few niggling puzzles left to sort out, but once they're sorted out, we'll have a complete understanding of the universe, and we'll all be able to share in the prize and the glory, and then we can all go do something else. Okay? Because we can just apply physics at that point until we're blue in the face. Okay? Here is the problem. Waves require a medium. Every wave that had ever been observed required a medium to travel in. Something has to compress and expand in order for a wave to travel. Well, the substance that electromagnetic waves travel in can't be air, because you can evacuate all the air out of a tank, for instance, and still transmit electromagnetic waves from one end to the other. Okay, you can still shoot light through empty space. If light is an electromagnetic wave, you look up at the stars at night, you know, there's one hydrogen atom in every cubic meter or so up there. It's not, you know, gas that's transmitting light. Something else must be the medium for light. That was the hypothesis at the end of the 1800s. And it got the name the ether. A-E-T-H-E-R. And I'm going to put a question mark at the end of this. The medium that transmits light. It was an unknown substance. Okay? Whatever it was, it had certainly never been observed, or, you know, it would have been easy to figure this one out. Maxwell's equations didn't seem to require a medium, though. There's no medium in Maxwell's equations. You can get rid of all the charges and still have electromagnetic waves propagating through space at the speed of light. So people just assume that Maxwell's equations must be wrong. I mean, they'd only been around for a few decades at that point. It's come the end of the 1800s. Newton's laws had been around for over 100 years. They were time-tested. They couldn't be wrong, okay? They describe waves as compressions and expansions in a medium, whether it's a string, an air, whatever, water, okay? Maxwell's equations must be crap, right? We just have to figure out what's wrong with Maxwell's equations, and all of this will be resolved. So, you know, they started treating the ether like it was a mechanical medium whose properties could be calculated based on those of light, and they started looking for it. And they devised all kinds of experiments to look for the ether. And then by the early 1900s, the late 1800s, a pair of scientists named Michelson and Morley had this really precise experiment that they were going to do. And they were absolutely confident, based on all the latest calculations of the ether, that they were going to observe it. They basically looked at how the speed of light changes when the light travels with the Earth's rotation and perpendicular to the Earth's rotation. The idea being that it would be traveling at different speeds through the ether, and they would detect that. So they did this really careful experiment with a big stone table floating on a pool of mercury to give it mechanical stability, with mirrors and lenses and light beams and all sorts of instruments to measure this. And they didn't measure anything. They saw no difference in the speed of light, regardless of whether they pointed the light beam with the Earth's rotation or perpendicular to it. It was like the Earth's motion, which they should have been able to detect on top of the speed of light. That's how sensitive this instrument was. The Earth's motion should have affected it. If it's really traveling through a medium, it should make a difference whether it travels with the Earth's motion through the ether or perpendicular to the Earth's motion through the ether. They saw nothing. Okay, so then there are all these crazy ideas. Well, maybe the Earth is dragging the ether with it, so you wouldn't see a difference in speed. So people said, okay, no problem. Starlight will be affected because it will bend through this dragged ether, and we should be able to detect that bending. And people went and looked for it, and they saw nothing. Okay, so the ether is both moving with the Earth and not moving with the Earth. And it became largely irrelevant as a result. You could concoct a crazy idea, how it's sort of half moving and not moving some of the time. When you make the observation, forget it. You know, Occam's razor, simplest explanation is probably the right one. So people started abandoning the idea that there was an ether. This happened very quickly over a period of just decades after Maxwell's equations arose. And the coda to all of this is that these niggling little problems, like the existence of the ether, the nature of light, which we're about to start playing around with as we do optics in this course, these seemingly stupid little questions about this thing, light, kicked off a revolution in our understanding of the universe through our complete misunderstanding of light and how it travels and whether it needs a medium. We had a revolution in the early 1900s, and it was led by this man, Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein was a graduate student in physics. He got his degree, and he pissed off so many people he couldn't get a job. So he had a family to support, and he took a job at the Swiss Patent Office in Bern, Switzerland. But he was brilliant, and he couldn't let things go. He had lots of friends in the physics community, but he just couldn't get a job. And so he slaved away in this patent office. He really enjoyed the work because it was very, you know, very straightforward work, filing and processing patents. And he could spend lots of time between his job thinking and doing calculations while he was at work. And what was bothering him was this whole notion that the speed of light appears to be independent of the state of motion. The Michelson-Morley experiment should have noticed. It was so sensitive. It should have noticed that when you travel with the Earth, that affects the speed of light differently than when you travel with light going perpendicular to the Earth's motion. And it really bothered him. And people were ready to throw out Maxwell's equations and say, well, we're just going to have to start over. A whole new theory of electricity and magnetism and light. And Einstein said, well, huh, what if Newton was wrong? You see, Newton assumed that the thing on which we all make our measurements, space and time, are absolute. That if, you know, especially time, that if I give a clock to Trang and ask her to measure the time it takes for something to happen, that if I start my measurement at the same time, I should get the same result as her, regardless of whether I'm running or on a plane or anything else, that my state of motion should have no impact on my perception of time. Einstein said, no, the speed of light is the only thing that's unaffected by two observers. It is constant, no matter what their state of motion. Michelson-Morley had shown the speed of light is unaffected by motion. If I'm moving very fast on a plane and I measure the speed of light from a flashlight that you shine at my plane, I will measure 3.0 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. If I'm standing next to the flashlight and somebody turns it on, I'm not moving at all with respect to the flashlight, I will still measure 3.0 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. Counterintuitive, but that's what the experiment said. Okay? And as Galileo kind of, you know, got himself in trouble for, if you make an observation of the natural world, that's probably the way that nature is. And so Einstein put this together. And he put this together in one of three papers that he published in 1905 while he was still a patent clerk. Okay? One of them was on atomic theory. It was on something called Brownian motion, which, if you look at dust in a little tank of water under a microscope, you'll see that the dust molecules are vibrating very quickly. This is called Brownian motion, and he interpreted this as atoms in the water are buffeting the dust molecule from all sides, and while on average their motions cancel each other out, the dust molecule is getting hit from left and right, and you can see it jiggle. There are places, museums of science, where you can go and you can look inside of a little microscope at dust particles in a tank of water, and you can see them just vibrating like crazy in there. Okay, and the hotter you make the water, the faster the vibration will occur. This was the first evidence, he argued, truly for the atomic theory of matter. Believe it or not, in 1905, people still hadn't really settled the question of whether there were atoms. But this was one of the things that really kicked it off. Okay. Also on the nature of light, there was an experiment called the photoelectric effect, where it was observed that if you shone light on a metal, you'd get an electric current. And people tried to explain this using the wave nature of light, the thing I've been talking about here today, that light is an electromagnetic wave, and it failed. This is again why people were willing to abandon Maxwell's equations, because they thought maybe it was just wrong. Albert Einstein says, whoa, maybe we've gotten it wrong. Maybe under some conditions light behaves like a wave, but in other conditions it behaves like a particle. Because if you interpret the photoelectric effect as light, little balls of light striking the electrons in the metal, it beautifully explains the experiment. That kicked off a revolution known as quantum mechanics. That is the theory of very small things. Okay, so Albert Einstein in 1905, in one of his three papers, kicked off a debate that has gone on till today about what truly, how truly do we interpret small things. And we describe that now using something called quantum mechanics. Okay, but there's still a big debate today about what it all means. And then finally, he reinterpreted space and time, keeping the speed of light constant. And he came up with this notion called relativity, that if I give Trang a clock that is identical to mine, and I get on a plane, and I measure something that's happening on the ground, so it's moving with respect to me, and she measures it standing next to the thing that's happening, we'll get different times. This has been done. You can take very sensitive atomic clocks, you can fly them on planes, put an identical atomic clock on the ground, and on the plane, if you go one direction with the Earth, against the Earth's rotation, you'll get one time measurement. If you go the other direction with the Earth's rotation, you'll get a different time. And if you put the clocks next to each other and make a measurement, you'll get the same time. So motion affects your perception of time. Okay, I do a problem in my modern physics class about how much longer you'll live by commuting at 75 miles an hour on Highway 75 every day for the rest of your life. I think it was like 10 to the minus 12 seconds or something. I mean, clearly the risks outweigh the benefit. But it's a real effect that has been measured many, many times. Particles that travel very fast, that decay, live longer when they travel faster because their clock slows down. It's very weird, but it's absolutely documented, and it's the basis of our current understanding of the universe. It allows us to build mobile phones. It allows us to build global positioning systems, because global positioning systems involve satellites that are moving very fast with respect to the surface of the Earth. If you don't understand relativity, you completely screw it up. Okay? You'll be off by 7 kilometers every day if you don't understand relativity. Okay? Revolutions start from simple questions. What is light? This work that we've been doing since the beginning of the semester is all intended to give you an understanding that attacking simple problems, you know, trying to cast it in the language of mathematics, can lead to deep insights about the universe. That light is an oscillating electric and magnetic phenomenon seems esoteric until you realize that now it's the basis of absolutely everything we do. Mobile communications is ubiquitous, right? If I take a look at the electromagnetic spectrum, we've pretty much planted flags as a species in just about every part of the spectrum. So we use our eyes to see, okay? So visible wavelengths are these tiny wavelengths right in here, wedged right in here. Professor McElgin, who taught this class last semester, I don't know if he did this example or not, but he showed that water transmits visible light very well, but it transmits UV and infrared very poorly. And since our eyes are mostly made of water, guess what? We're very sensitive to seeing visible light, and we're terrible at seeing infrared, ultraviolet, X-rays, all the stuff that light doesn't transmit very well, because water is such an important part of our biology. Okay, that's this narrow little piece in here. Infrared, we've got remote controls, we've got telecommunications by optical fiber, which again is, you know, ubiquitous. Night vision relies on being able to see infrared. It uses the photoelectric effect, actually, to make dark things visible. Ultraviolet light, well, dental curing, that's a good example of one place it's used. When they put that light in your mouth, they put an epoxy on your tooth to heal up a crack, or they fill in a drill hole. They then shine ultraviolet light on it, and that hardens it almost instantaneously. Okay, so UV light, very useful. Suntan, also very useful. Okay, but also very dangerous. Medical X-rays, more dangerous version of the suntan. Okay, baggage screening, crystallography, positron electron tomography, using antimatter to image parts of the body. Okay, that all relies on gamma rays and X-rays. Going down into the long wavelength part of the spectrum, you've got radio, mobile phones, TV, ultrasound, sound waves, microwave ovens. We planted a flag in this entire spectrum, and it all came out of Maxwell's theory. Okay? So what we're going to do next is we're going to study this tiny, tiny little piece right here, visible light. And I'll have some demonstrations of light scattering on Wednesday, basically involving a large tank of water, some milk powder, and a laser. So get ready, okay? So it'll be a short homework this week because we have an exam. We're only going to cover one bit of new material this week. So that'll be due on Monday in the evening. And then we have Thanksgiving after that, so we'll get, one lecture in next week, and it'll be another short homework after that. Okay, so the next 2 weeks, we're going to be doing optics, which is mostly algebra, and in addition, you'll have some low-impact homework assignments to deal with, okay?